and welcome to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver's Co-op Radio, broadcasting live from the downtown east side on unceded Coast Salish territories. My name is Alyssa. I'm joined in studio today by Allison.
Hey there.
And Tim.
Hello.
And Jackie.
Hello.
Today is Friday, November 23rd, 2012. We have special programming for you today in honor of the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. That's Sunday, November 25th. Just a bit about that. Up to 70% of women worldwide experience violence in their lifetime. Violence against women occurs because of the persistent discrimination against women and the idea that women are lesser beings. In this patriarchal system of hierarchical dominance, those closer to the bottom of the rungs take the brunt of the violence. In Canada, for example, Indigenous women are 5 times more likely than other women of the same age to die as a result of violence. Over half of women with disabilities have experienced physical abuse, compared to 1/3 of non-disabled women. And, of course, arguably, the patriarchal oppression that's at the root of that violence is the very same oppression that keeps animals down. And we're going to draw some links today. We have two feature interviews. The first is a tribute to the life and work of prominent vegan activist, scholar, author, and eco-feminist Marty Keel, PhD. And later in the show, we speak with Phil Arkow about the link between animal abuse and domestic violence. He's the coordinator and co-founder of the National Link Coalition in the U.S. And we look forward to speaking to both of those guests. First, though, we're going to start with a cookbook review. And, Oh, and it's also Fur Free Friday today. Every year.
Every Friday is.
Every Friday? Isn't it November 23rd, though? Like the.
I think November.
Third November in.
I think they take place in various areas, but.
I know the official one's in November. I was at it once. It was cold.
Yeah, I guess today there's you might mention at Winners today. So we'll leave that up to you in the events.
Hi, everyone. So yeah, talking about a cookbook now, I finally am presenting another cookbook review today. Throughout the past year, I've been really enjoying testing out some of the recipes from one of the most recent popular vegan cookbooks to hit the presses, and that's called Spork Fed, Super Fun and Flavorful Vegan Recipes from the Sisters of Spork Foods, who are Jenny Engel and Heather Goldberg. So who are the Sisters of Spork Foods? You might have heard of them before. They're a sibling duo who live in the Los Angeles area, and they run a gourmet vegan food company offering in-person and online cooking classes, catering, food consultations, and more. You might have seen them online on YouTube. They've got some great videos on there. They seem to be very successful at what they're doing, and they're both committed vegans, and Jenny is trained at the National Gourmet Institute in New York City, so they do know a thing or two about food. And actually, you'll find from reading the book that they do know a lot about food just from their sophisticated cooking methods and the different flavors that they join together and all the extra information that they include about ingredients and so forth in the book. So the book, in the presentation of the book itself, is really beautiful. It's glossy. I don't know if you guys had a chance to see it. You can take a look at it right now. Very glossy, full color photos of each recipe, and each recipe is clearly laid out and easy to read. And it also comes with, as I mentioned, additional interesting facts about the food to make the reader further indulge in what they're about to make. The tone of the book is fun, and if a cookbook sounds fun for me, I think that's what even makes it even more so wants me to make recipes out of it. So like I said, I've been enjoying making recipes from here. I made, if you remember, I brought pizza about a month or so ago that Alyssa and Tim got to have, caramelized onions and homemade barbecue sauce, and I know you enjoyed that, Alyssa. That
yeah, I have kind of a bad memory, but I will believe you. That sounds really
tasty.
You have
a bad memory? I remember
the pizza
you were
was
like,
very good.
Yeah, I remember that, and it was very, for me, it was memorable. So today we had some food. Today I made just sort of a sampling of some of the food in the book. I made the corn cakes with a smoky paprika sauce and the quinoa salad with fennel and white beans and a light lemon vinaigrette, the creamy baked macaroni and cheese with a breadcrumb topping, and for dessert we had pumpkin cheesecake with a ginger snap crust. So what did you guys think? Let's talk.
Well, I enjoyed the corn cakes. I thought that was...
Oh, yeah?
I'd never had... They're just little, yeah, little mm-hmm. corn cakes with sort of kernels in them and the sauce. I think that's like a nice
yeah,
kind
I enjoyed
of
the corn cakes.
It's a little appetizer.
Yeah. As I said, I really liked the pizza you brought the other day, but I have mm-hmm. to say the stuff today didn't quite make it for me. I found it all a bit...
Was it a bit too bland for
yeah,
you? I think
I
that's
found
what
it
I found
all a bit
too.
Bland.
Yeah,
see,
I found that as well.
I think the quinoa in itself was really delicious. Like if you're just going to have a quinoa
yeah,
salad.
Yeah, but quinoa is always yeah. delicious.
Yeah, so there you go. The quinoa was delicious. When I made the spicy seitan buffalo wings, and that's an appetizer with a pear, fig, and sage tarts with a roasted garlic aioli, and I believe I did bring some here. I think only Alyssa had some. This was months and months ago. I made it for a work event of mine, and those were just so popular, and they went over really well, and everyone was asking me about them because it was at a non-vegan workplace, so I wrote little notes as to what they were with vegan circled. So because spicy barbecue wings, and people are like, okay, I know this isn't meat. What is it? No one knew what seitan was, but they all found it really delicious. Those two recipes are just amazing. There's actually a video for the sage pig and pear tarts online on YouTube that you can see. I've made a lot of the other recipes as well, so I'm finding that definitely there are a lot of them work well, some don't so well. I made cinnamon buns that I think I brought you some, Alyssa. I didn't think they worked out too well, but other than that, I made some peanut butter mousse for my birthday cake out of this a few weeks ago. It's really delicious. And I made actually the vanilla birthday cake with a buttercream frosting and sprinkles for my friend's birthday about a month ago, and he really liked that. That turned out really well. There's a lot of really interesting different recipes in here, and I've just named some of them. Other ones that I want to make that sound really delicious, a roasted butternut squash and sage lasagna with a creamy bechamel sauce, the potato gnocchi with a basil and roasted shallot cream sauce, the scallion pancakes with a sweet and sour dipping sauce, and the miso glazed Japanese eggplant. I think the book for myself, it's addictive to read and to cook from because it's very adventurous, and it's got definitely a blend of different flavors and recipes that you're not going to find everywhere else. And I do encourage you to check out the Spork Sisters website to find out more about them, sporkfoods.com. There's lots there to see. And I think this book would make a really good gift. The holidays are coming up, and it's just really nice and pretty to look at, and there's lots of interesting stuff in there. So I do recommend it for people who are into really creative, innovative, and tasty recipes that you want to add to your plant-based repertoire.
All right. Thanks for that. And we have a busy weekend coming up for events. Actually, today, like Alyssa mentioned earlier, we have Fur Free Friday at Winners. That's from 1 to 3, so right after the show. So with 213 stores Canada-wide, most Canadians have no idea that Winners is one of the largest, if not the largest, retailers of cheap, cruel, fur-trimmed products in the country. So the main problem with that is that many people don't know that they're buying fur-trimmed garments because they're labeled as faux fur. So please check your labels for materials. And tomorrow, that's Saturday, November 24th, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., we have the Taiji Dolphin Project, and that takes place at the Vancouver Art Gallery, 750 Hornby Street in Vancouver. And this event is to protest the annual Taiji Dolphin Call, as seen in the Academy Award-winning documentary, The Cove. The message is positive to Japan, let the dolphins live and be free. So this is a worldwide event. People from all over the world will be speaking out on the same day. The activists will start at the Vancouver Art Gallery at 11 a.m. and then take a leisurely stroll past the Japanese Embassy building at 1075 West Pender Street, where they will gather outside to protest peacefully. The organizers invite everyone to come out and participate. So this is a great opportunity to make our voices be heard and mark the day that will encourage all media to Taiji to report exactly what is happening at the Cove. And then on Sunday, again this weekend, November 25th at 6 p.m., Liberation BC presents an outreach event at the Paul McCartney concert. I heard, Alyssa, are you going to this? Or?
Oh, yeah. I love Lisa. I'll be there.
So that sounds like a great event. I'm not sure if I'll be able to make it, but I'll try my best. It's kind of, Sundays are hard for me. But this is at 777 Pacific Boulevard in Vancouver, BC Place. So Paul McCartney is going to be performing in Vancouver, and since Paul is a longtime animal rights activist, this is a perfect time to do some outreach to his fans. So volunteers will be meeting to hand out some vegan outreach leaflets to a crowd of 52,000. They'll be meeting at the Dunsmuir and Beattie entrance, known as the downtown entrance of the Stadium Chinatown SkyTrain station at 6 p.m., and then heading across the street to BC Place to welcome Paul and his fans with signs, costumes, and lots of leaflets.
Are you going to that, Alyssa?
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. I want to hear about it next week.
Okay. And what else do we have going on? On Sunday, December 2nd at 7:30, we have an evening called Veg Simplicity, Veg Diplomacy with vegan registered dietitian Vicento Molina. And that's at Eternal Abundance Restaurant at 1025 Commercial Drive. And that's in Vancouver. So join the staff at Eternal Abundance for an informative and tasty evening with well-known vegan dietitian and author Vicento Molina. With the holidays approaching, it's especially important to learn easy, tasty ways to fit health-supportive foods into busy lives. Vicento will help you come up with new, simple ideas for nutritious breakfast, lunches, dinners, and snacks on vegan and raw food diets, and celebration meals that everyone will enjoy, as well as consider how to navigate through the holiday season and celebrate with family and friends whose dietary patterns differ from your own. Entry fee is $10 and includes organic, raw vegan snacks.
Oh, thanks for that, Jackie. That's a lot of stuff happening
busy
in the next week. So now we're going to turn to a bit of a tribute. Prominent scholar, author, and animal rights activist, and eco-feminist, and all-around amazing person from what I have learned in the last month, Marty Keel, passed away from leukemia on November 19th, 2011. To tell us more about the legacy of Marty Keel, we're turning to our guest, Lori Gruen. Along with Carol J. Adams, author of the book The Sexual Politics of Meat, Lori organized an event which took place earlier in November called Finding a Niche for All Animals, a conference honoring the eco-feminist work of Marty Keel. Lori Gruen, PhD, is a professor of philosophy, feminist, gender and sexuality studies, and environmental studies at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. She coordinates the Animal Studies Department there and directs the Ethics in Society Project. She's also the author of the book Ethics and Animals, an Introduction, published last year. Lori, can you please introduce us to Marty Keel and tell us a bit about your relationship with her?
Well, Marty Keel was really a pioneer in so many ways. She was, as you mentioned, she was a very prominent animal advocate and activist, and she was also the founder of Feminists for Animal Rights, and was also in very important ways engaged in nature ethics. That's the title of her book, and she brought her ecofeminist theoretical and activist perspective to bear on environmental ethics more broadly, and that included animal ethics as well. I met Marty back in a long time ago in 1983 at the Mobilization for Animals conference in Davis, California, and we had been in touch with each other on and off over many, many, many years. She was a terrific inspiration for me because she was somebody who, even though she didn't have a PhD at the time, was able to take on a lot of men who were very prominent in the academy and in the animal movement and in the environmental movement. And she was really a terrific inspiration.
Wow. So you were inspired by her life and her work to bring together this conference, which happened on November 9th and 10th. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, I was supposed to have seen Marty the day before she died. She was living in Connecticut with her sister, Jane. And we didn't get to see each other that day. And I was very saddened, of course, by her untimely death. And so together with our good friend Carol Adams, we decided that it would be a terrific tribute to Marty's work and life to put together this conference, which was just a real historic event last week, 2 weeks ago. Carol and I are putting together a volume of work to move ecofeminist theory forward.
All right, so let's talk about what ecofeminism is. I don't think I wasn't very aware of it until learning about Marty's work, and I don't think it's a very common term. So can you give us a bit of a background for that?
Yeah, so ecofeminism, it had a certain heyday, as it were, in the 90s, and then sort of was quiet for a little while, and I think it's coming back into discussion. What early ecofeminists were interested in doing were highlighting the ways that multiple interlocking oppressions were sort of conceptually linked together. So if you had, and you could see the oppression and exploitation of women, the exploitation of animals, the denigration and commodification of the natural world, the ways in which other marginal groups have been sort of used. These were all sort of thought to be connected. We thought there were important connections that were being overlooked. And so ecofeminism was in large part designed to bring these connections to a fore.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So what would you say Marty Keel's contribution to the movement was?
The movement, well, Marty was, in terms of the animal movement, she was really centrally important in, as I said earlier, she was a founding member of Feminists for Animal Rights. And in there was a small study group that started in the early 80s, and from that, Feminists for Animal Rights emerged. And the group Feminists for Animal Rights tried to bring animal issues to feminist groups and feminist issues to animal groups as part of this early days of connecting these mutually reinforcing oppressions that ecofeminists are concerned about. And Marty, through Feminists for Animal Rights, and up until really right before she died, was very active in the animal movement, making sure that gender and gender exclusion and gender oppression and racial exclusion and racial oppression and exclusions based on sexuality, all of that was called. And she was very active in helping women who were experiencing abuse in their relationships and maybe even in the animal rights movement. The Feminists for Animal Rights, one of the things that they were real pioneers with was making sure that women who were looking to leave abusive relationships didn't have to leave their companion animals behind. Because back in the 80s, it was not very common if a woman had to seek shelter that she could also bring her companion animal with her. And that often left women in positions where they were in dangerous situations because they didn't want to leave their dogs or cats at home. So Marty and Feminists for Animal Rights were very active in trying to make those issues important issues for animal advocates.
Wow, yeah, that's interesting, because that's actually, we're hosting an interview later in the show about the connections between domestic violence and animal abuse, and it seems like in the last few years especially, that's, people are really getting that link, and more shelters are trying to find alternative homes for dogs and cats, and for shelters to accept women with animals, and also to note that animal abuse is connected. So yeah, we look forward to learning more about that in the next interview. It's interesting to hear that that was already starting in the early 80s.
Yeah, it's a very important part of the work that Feminists for Animal Rights did.
And is Feminists for Animal Rights still active, or was it?
Well, still, it's good. It's good that you mentioned that. So it's not. It hadn't been active for a little while, but it's there's a new website that has just been restarted, and it has all of the Feminists for Animal Rights newsletters available online, so you can actually find and read about these early campaigns to draw connections between domestic violence and violence against animals and violence against women and various forms of other kinds of homophobia and that sort of thing, all in the these early newsletters. So they're now all available, and that's thanks to Jane Stanley, who was Marty Keel's sister and who's been very generous and was with Marty in her last months, and also very supportive of our conference that we really were. The whole Keel family was really supportive of the conference, and it was quite an amazing conference. We brought together activists and scholars, and it was really exciting to have younger students and people who had been around in both the feminist movement and the animal movement for so many years. It was really quite a moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read a number of people's experiences who attended the conference, and they all seemed very moved by it, and even just reading their descriptions, I got just really excited, and reading about Marty's life, it just brought tears to my eyes. It seemed like it was a very successful event, and I'm curious about future events. Are you planning, do you plan this to be maybe an annual event, or not sure yet?
No, I don't think we'll be able to do an annual event, no. It's quite a lot to put this together, but as I said, a number of people have who are presenting at the conference, including Patrice Jones of Vine Sanctuary, Greta Gard, another friend and longtime ecofeminist, of course, Carol Adams, Bacha Bauman, who is one of the other early founders of Feminists for Animal Rights, Kim Stallwood, who has been active in both the British and the U.S. animal movement for many years. Many people were involved in the conference and are going to be writing for our volume, which is going to be looking at, again, what I was suggesting, the ways that these various intersecting oppressions can feed off each other. And by looking at these, the ways in which various kinds of oppressive or exploitive practices might be so conceptually held together, we could start to undo it and dismantle this these structures.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there is that it's not exactly easy to bring some groups together, the feminist movement and the animal rights and environmental movement have been kind of moving parallel, but not so much crossing over, or in ways that are really inspiring crossing over, but there's still seems like really people that are really staunchly against them coming together. Can you just talk a bit about that, sort of how...
Yeah. It is a really interesting question that you raise. And, of course, within every movement, whether it's the feminist movement or the animal movement or the environmental movement, there's differences, right? There's always differences in all of these movements. One of the reasons that I think we see some resistance, particularly from feminists against animals, is the long-time association of women with animals that's been denigrating in a way that's been very made people feel less than. And I think that one of the big hurdles to get over has been getting through that particular block. And I think there's also a lack of sort of understanding of these mechanisms. So one of the things that ecofeminists have been, many ecofeminists, and again, not all ecofeminists have the same views, but many ecofeminists have tried to point out is the way that female animal bodies are used in the production of milk and the production of eggs, for example, and that exploitation of the reproductive capacities is not that unlike the exploitation of women's bodies in all sorts of ways. And so drawing those connections can really help people to start to make more alliances across various kinds of differences. And I think one of the important things that has come out in the conference, and it's really become more interesting as ecofeminism moves into the 21st century, is that we're not just talking about women and animals and the environment, but we also need to be thinking very importantly about sexuality and about race and about ability and about ethnicity. So all of these ways that others get constructed, animal others and other races and other sexualities, all of that is a central part of what ecofeminism is trying to both analyze and start to change.
Mm. Yeah,
but it's hard work. I mean, as you said, there are these obstacles. And one of the things that Marty was really amazing at in her work on nature ethics, she tried to show how the way that environmentalists have been paying attention to the whole ignores the individuals and the individual lives and suffering that are important. And one of the central features of ecofeminism, at least how I think Marty and Carol and myself and Greta and Josephine Donovan, who are theorizing in this way, all share, is that it doesn't make sense to think about our relationship to nature as nature's out there and we're in here, but that we're deeply in relationship. And so one of the things that feminists and ecofeminists have been focusing on is the way that we're already connected, we're already in these relationships. And if we were to develop our true empathy and compassion and care, we can make a lot of difference, both amongst humans, but also in relationships with other animals and with the rest of the natural world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one thing I noticed was, in her book, Nature Ethics, as I understand, I haven't read the book, but that it sort of criticizes the male bias of both the beginnings of the environmental movement and the animal rights movement. Can you talk just a bit about that?
Yeah, so there is an idea that Marty developed that I think is really an important idea, and she was critical of this idea, and she said that there's this sense of sort of the heroic, so, and she associated heroic ethics with a type of sort of masculinity, and so the idea that she had was that somehow we need sort of heroes to come and save the day, and I always think of it sort of that sort of image of a sort of damsel in distress needing some male hero to sort of saunter in and save the damsel. But one of the things that Marty was really critical of is that model for thinking about both how our problems come to be and how we might solve our problems. And so she thought that heroic ethics was based on what she called a truncated narrative, where you start with a problem and you then only see one kind of heroic solution to the problem, rather than trying to ask larger, broader questions about what brought us to the problem in the first place, what are the relationships that are in place that have contributed to the problem, how did those relationships come about, how might we alter those relationships so that people can actually begin to help themselves rather than have some male hero come in and save the day. And so within environmentalism, this should be familiar within animal advocacy, but and also within environmentalism, there's also a sort of kind of male leaders or male spokespeople or male kind of authorities, and Marty was very critical of that model and tried very hard in everything she did to try to change and provide a different alternative model.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, because it is interesting that something like 70% of people in the animal rights movement at least are women. I think there's statistics on that. So.
But what you're saying is that, however, the leaders are men? Because I've seen that criticism come up before. Is that what you're alluding to?
Yeah, Marty. Well, I think things have changed since Marty, first began making those criticisms.
Right.
But it was an important criticism at the time. There's a sense in which there are a lot of spokespeople are often men. And,
right.
To be fair, we live in a culture in which men are still dominant over women. Men make more money than women. Men are thought to be the authorities over women. So in that sense, you can understand why some animal advocacy organizations would want to have male spokespeople, because men are listened to and women aren't listened to often. But nonetheless, this is sort of one of the criticisms that Marty and ecofeminists have made, is that, yes, we live in a culture in which a male-dominated culture, but that doesn't mean that we should adopt that same pattern of exclusion in our advocacy work. And so part of what Marty argued very early on, and this is why she was such an inspiration, I think, she really was sort of at the forefront of making these kinds of critiques, when you often only saw men doing the talking, and as you said, the large majority of women make up the animal movement.
Mm-hmm. I think that's all we have time for today, though. I feel like I could talk to you for much longer. I really wanted to thank you for spending time with us today and sharing a bit about the life and legacy of Marty Keel and shedding some light on ecofeminism. And it's been very illuminating. And thank you so much, Lori.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Use the F word we say it live on the radio. Maybe you've heard. Mondays at noon, we go for an hour. We talk about culture, gender, race, class, and power. We're bringing sexy back under attack. Cause it's about time folks started taking some flack for promoting a culture where you must be a pessimist if you want to speak your mind and say something feminist, but we know it's not true. From the truth you can't run. Feminists simply have so much more fun. If the trash that you hear makes you angry or bored, check out the F word at feminisms.org.
Hi there, so I have some, actually one news story for you guys. That is you know, very touching to me. And actually, I just want to remind you guys, too, you are listening to Vancouver's Co-op Radio. That's 100.5 CFRO, broadcasting live from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. So the story that I have to tell you about is it's actually in BC along the Alaska Highway, and it's related to a wolf kill contest, which is quite disturbing. Basically, how it works is people are paid money based on the size of the wolf, the biggest wolf, the smallest wolf, various types of wolves. And this, here's just some information about it. An accomplished nature photographer is just urging a tourism boycott of the Alaska Highway next year to protest a contest offering, like I said, cash and prizes for hunting wolves. So John Marriott, who grew up in Salmon Arm but lives in Canmore, Alberta, says he believes the hunt is unethical and should be stopped immediately. So a story in the Vancouver Sun on Tuesday revealed that hunters who enter the contest and kill the biggest wolves stand to receive between $250 to $1,000 and up. There's also a booby prize of $150 for the smallest wolves, and draws for prizes such as rifle and free taxidermy work. The contest continues through March 31st, with each hunter able to enter up to 3 wolves. Sponsors of the contest include the Peace River Rod and Gun Club. It costs $50 to enter the contest, with winners receiving 10 to 40% the entry prize pool, in addition to the guaranteed prizes of $150 to $1,000.
I just got back on the air. Are you promoting this contest? I'm kidding.
Absolutely not.
That would be a different show, right?
I was extremely disturbed when I actually found this, so that's why I'm just making people aware.
The Vancouver Humane Society has actually been putting out bulletins about just, like, get them to stop this disgusting. I read all about it, too.
And calling never works. It never, honestly, if you want to help save the moose and all the deer, everything, just stop hunting them. That'll be the real solution for this problem. Advertising for this event depicts a snarling wolf, and it's very vicious looking, and that's just the sort of image that is not typically observed in the wild. That's just the image. It's the same as propaganda that
I see it as. Yeah,
exactly.
Propaganda and marketing of an image, a message that a certain group wants to portray.
It's the same thing.
It's not depicting what reality is.
Exactly. It's the same thing that army officials use, and very similar propaganda.
It's like almost like calling Muslims terrorists or something.
Exactly.
It's like wolves are monsters, that's evil monsters.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like,
and they're not. They're very peaceful. Family-oriented
wolves are
animals.
Dogs. You know, the one,
exactly.
When I read this story, I'm like, if there was a contest to go out and shoot dogs, as we know them, they're dogs.
And they have 96% of the same DNA. So just please keep this in mind if you're planning on going to that area of BC at all this year. Thank you.
I have a related news story, which is actually a good news. The National Geographic reports that there will be no more hunting of any kind in Botswana. And the president of Botswana, Lieutenant General Ian Khama, just announced recently at a public meeting that no further hunting licenses would be issued from 2013, and all the hunting in Botswana would be impossible by 2014.
What do they hunt there? Lions and tigers?
Yeah,
and
they
elephants?
Hunt all kind of wild animals.
A lot of endangered species.
A lot of endangered species. Yeah. It's partly the traditional hunting, but a lot of it is also tourist hunting, like tourists coming there to hunt. And it is an important economic factor for the region, but I think Botswana is really leading the way. They are switching over to photo safaris so that people can shoot animals with their cameras. And this is much more sustainable. And even though some people fear that hunters might just go to other countries in Africa now, Still, I think if everybody would follow their lead, this is really the way to go. I think it's similar, as you can see here in Canada, where whale hunting has been transformed into whale watching. And people really realize this is a much more sustainable way.
I think it's also imperative for one part of that nation to make the first step, because that's the only thing that will get others to follow on. I'm finding that with the shark fin issue in Canada, and especially in BC, it's like
it needs to start somewhere.
Yeah, it needs to start somewhere. And once it starts, it's one after another, others will follow suit.
I just have one short recommendation. If you're interested about how all this hunting works, there's a really, really good documentary by the BBC, by Louis Theroux. It's called African Hunting Holiday, and it's really shocking. You can find it on YouTube. It's very illuminating. I recommend everybody to watch that.
Thanks, Tim. So now we're returning to our special programming in honor of the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. Phil Arkow is the coordinator and co-founder of the National Link Coalition and a consultant for the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals and the Animals and Society Institute. He also chairs the Latham Foundation's Animal Abuse and Family Violence Prevention Project. He trains internationally on a variety of topics for animal shelters, child protection agencies, domestic violence programs, adult protective services, law enforcement, judges, and veterinarians. He also teaches certificate courses in animal-assisted therapy. Thank you so much for joining us today, Phil, to talk about what is known as The Link.
My pleasure. Glad to be chatting with you lovely ladies.
And Tim.
And Tim, okay, I can't see you. I heard two voices, that's
all.
He is
lovely, though.
He is, quite.
Melissa thinks so.
So first, Phil, can you just tell us what is The Link?
Well, The Link is basically the areas where all forms of family violence intersect, and it's only been in the last few decades that this human services community has begun to recognize that when we're talking about family violence, we have to include animal cruelty or animal abuse or animal neglect into that mix, because all these agencies, whether it's an SPCA like the BC SPCA up your way, or a Humane Society in some other communities, or a local animal control agency, they're dealing with the same perpetrators as our police departments or social service agencies who are working with people in domestic violence, child abuse, or elder abuse. And all too often, each agency has had blinders on, just working its own cases without realizing that on any given case that they're on, their investigators might see two, three, or even four types of family violence co-occurring. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to do with the National Link Coalition is to get agencies to set up cross-training programs, cross-reporting programs, collaborations, community coalitions, so that all these agencies are working together, because we haven't made as much progress as we could have by working independently, but perhaps by taking a more holistic view towards violence against women, violence against children, violence against seniors and the disabled, and violence against animals, we'll all be much better off, and particularly the victims themselves.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, how serious is this problem? Can you give us some statistics of the overlap?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, you know, one study in the UK, for example, found 81% of families being investigated for child abuse were also being investigated by the Royal SPCA.
Wow.
We've had a dozen different studies in the U.S., and plus Canada, plus New Zealand, and several other countries, showing that upwards of 71% of battered women say that their batterer also abused, tortured, or killed their animals as a way to retaliate against them or to intimidate them and to force them to return home. And routinely, anywhere from 18 to 48% of battered women say that fear for their animals' welfare is one of the significant reasons why they don't leave. I mean, obviously, domestic violence is a huge, complex issue, and there are lots of reasons why she doesn't leave and why she keeps coming back. But by setting up programs to protect the animal members of the family, we can eliminate at least that barrier and get thousands and thousands of battered women and their kids and their animals out of an abusive home.
Mm-hmm. So it's my understanding that there's different kinds of animal abuse that abusers may utilize with like different methods to achieve different kinds of control. Can you give me, I know you gave me just a couple examples there, but can you kind of expand on how abusers might manipulate animals in order to affect women or her, for example?
We've seen everything from the batterers, you know, forcing, you know, it's usually a male battering a woman, but of course we have intimate partner violence and gay and lesbian relationships and a few women battering men, and the numbers in all those situations are very comparable. But, you know, a typical situation is he forces her to watch animal pornography or eat out of the dog bowl. A child sex abuser, you know, telling the child that if he or she talks, he'll kill the pet. The abuser killing or threatening the animal and saying, you know, if you leave, this is what will happen to you, or if you leave, I'll kill your animal. A new study just came out in New Zealand found that the pets of the survivor's friend, the domestic violence survivor's friends, are equally at risk because the batterer will torture or kill those animals to as retribution against their helping her escape. A couple of key Canadian studies found the issue affects livestock on farms as well. And again, the women are trapped because she's worried about who's going to take care of the animals if she leaves. So, I mean, those are just some of the main type of scenarios we see. And then, of course, we get into the impact of kids who torture or kill animals and what that does for their antisocial development. We've had a study in Chicago found 31% of teenagers have been to a dog fight. So, I mean, it just takes a lot of different forms, none of which are good.
All right, and you mentioned often that the abusers are using animals to manipulate women to stay with them. Do you find that often women are more likely to come forward if their animals are in distress or being tortured as well?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things we tell women in these situations is we recognize it's a complex issue. But if he's, you know, and many times they blame themselves and they make apologies for the guy and they say, you know, it was something I did and, you know, if I just change, he'll be better. And what we tell these women is, no, that's a lie. I mean, if he's hurting the animals, it's not because of the animals' fault. It's because of a problem with him. And that should tell you something. And if he's hurting the animals, you're next. Get out now. And we can help you do that. We've got programs set up to help the women escape with their kids and their pets.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, actually, I mean, I don't know what place this has in the show, really, but I feel like mentioning that I had a friend whose partner was kicking her dog and actually kicked the dog down the stairs. And I said, you need to leave this guy. Like, and eventually, I think I talked her into it. I showed her some studies and everything, and I helped her move out of that. But that was, like, really scary. It was like, no, that's a warning sign.
Yeah, I mean, as they say, it takes anywhere from 8 to 15 times before she, you know, actually gets up the nerve to leave. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the animal abuse is a real red flag, and it's a real warning sign that she needs to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. Are there certain kinds of or ways to tell if the animal abuse might lead to risk of committing future violence, or if there might be that sort of overlap there? Are there certain markers for that type of violence?
Yeah, it's a little complicated, too much to go into in short time on the air, but we have a whole checklist of dangerous, you know, the risk of dangerousness, the risk of lethality, you know, list of indicators about the type and duration of the animal abuse and how malicious it is, how intensely involved with it he gets personally as to, you know, what his long-term risk is for other forms of violence. I mean, conventional wisdom, you know, says that every little boy who hurts animals are going to grow up to become a serial killer. That's not true, but a significant number of them do. Mm-hmm. And it works both ways. Very often, the abuse of the animals desensitizes somebody against violence, and they move on to hurting people, but it can work in reverse. And that shows us that it's just all different forms of antisocial behavior and a violent personality. And often, whether the animal is abused or whether it's a human that's abused, is a matter of convenience as much as anything else.
Mm-hmm. Now let's go back to solutions for this problem and the National Link Coalition that you're part of, for example, and the work you do with them. I noticed that there are actually similar national coalition groups, a few around the world. I wanted to just focus for a minute on, I did find that there is one in the Vancouver area and also one in Edmonton, but just for our listeners in Vancouver, it's the Violence Link Project, and it's the BCSPCA, along with Victim Services Division of the Ministry of Public Safety, and the BC Yukon Transition Houses, the BC Veterinary Medical Association, and the BC Institute Against Family Violence have a coalition, and they have links on their websites with more information, and I found that very interesting to learn.
Yeah, the BC or Vancouver was into this very, very early on, back in the 1990s, and they have a long history of doing this. In some areas, you guys are ahead of us down here in the States in terms of awareness of this. The Alberta SPCA just published a new report just this week. If you go to the Alberta SPCA website and look up the Cruelty Connection, you'll find an excellent report. It's a survey of the situation in Alberta. So there's a lot going on. The Canadian Veterinary Medical Association have taken a major lead in this worldwide in terms of getting veterinarians primed to report animal cruelty and get involved with this. So a lot going on up your way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as someone who works in the veterinary field, what are some things that animal care professionals should look out for as signs of domestic violence, and what are their responsibilities to report things that they are suspicious about, and how do we go about it, particularly with relation to confidentiality agreements that we are often bound by?
Well, confidentiality is a tricky one, but in both the U.S. and Canada, the National Veterinary Associations have given veterinarians explicit permission to violate the patient-client confidentiality to report suspected animal abuse to the investigating agency, which is usually a provincial SPCA. And that is a major step forward. When it comes to their reporting child abuse or domestic violence, it's a little squishier there, and veterinarians just haven't received a lot of training in that. They're reluctant to get involved. But I've done a lot of writing on this, and it's an exact same parallel situation to what happened with physicians back in the 1960s. Regarding reporting suspected child abuse. And it's just a matter of time and training and making them, you know, giving them explicit permission to do this, both either through statute changes, through changing the laws, or through organizational policies. For example, the National Association of Social Workers here in the U.S. allow social workers to break confidentiality if others in the family are at risk. And, you know, this would seem to be a classic case of an opportunity for them to break that confidentiality restriction if necessary.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a danger of animal abusers who go to the vet to get their pet, you know, fixed up, to be knowing that they might be reported by the vet for that issue and what other issues may also be arising in the household? So do you think that is a factor for being dissuaded to bring their animals in?
Again, it's the exact same argument that the physicians used when it came to child abuse. And the reality is we've found in several studies that animal abusers see the veterinarians at the same level, and child abusers see veterinarians at pretty much the same level as non-abusive homes. And particularly if there's a law that says they have to report it, that just ends the argument right there. Mm-hmm. And we tell veterinarians who are reluctant to do this, you know, are these the kind of people you want as a client? And they say, no, not really. I said, well, then don't be afraid to report them.
Right. I would just think they might be afraid because then in the future, other animal abusers aren't going to come in with their animals because they know that those veterinarians are going to report them.
There is that possibility, but very often it's not the abuser who's bringing the animal in. It's the
right.
abuser's spouse.
Right. So I don't know how that works exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So she, you know, she has to feel comfortable being able to speak freely and seeing the veterinarian as a caregiver who cares about all members of the family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're training veterinarians. These are the telltale signs you look for domestic violence, for suspected child abuse. and here's who you call in your community if you see any of this, and train vets that they are not judge and jury on this. Their obligation is to report their suspicions to the appropriate agency. Let that agency investigate, and if there's something to pursue, they will pursue it, and if there isn't, they won't.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what kinds of changes in the laws would help prevent these types of domestic abuse from occurring that might include animals.
Well, a number of things. First of all, one is huge movement we're seeing down here in the States is what we call PPOs, which stands for pet protection orders, and we now have 23 of our 50 states which specifically allow judges to include animals, whether it's livestock or pets, in protection from abuse orders. And so it's a restraining order, essentially, to keep the animal away from the pets. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, to keep the batterer away from the pets. Another huge change that we would love to see, and Canada could take the worldwide lead in this, you've had a bill pending up there for about the last 15 years, and it always passes one of your parliamentary houses and fails in the other one, and then you change your government, they got to start all over again. But it's a bill that would move the crime of animal cruelty out of the crimes against property section and move it to where it truly belongs, into a crime of aggression. And that would get people to recognize what animal cruelty is, which is it's a crime of aggression. It's a serious crime. It's not just a property crime. Right. I mean, I'd like to say that, unfortunately, animals are in the same legal category as toasters, but no battered woman ever stayed with her abuser to protect her toaster.
Mm-hmm.
So if Canada can ever pass that statute, that would have global implications and huge implications in Canada for getting animal cruelty recognized for, you know, the serious offense that it really is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I saw also, I think that abuse towards animals, you can't really explain it away by saying, oh, I lost control or something. It's such a directed, intentional kind of abuse that it's really hard to explain away. So I hope the law...
Not necessarily. The majority of cases, 95% of cases that the BCSBCA investigates, are neglect cases,
oh, okay.
The crimes of omission, okay? Huh. And the fact is, every different type of cruelty has a different motivation. Some of them are indeed intentional. Some of them are designed to manipulate. Some of them are psychopathic behavior. Some of them are just unfortunate circumstances. The little old lady who's hoarding 100 cats in her barn is approaching this differently than the teenage boy who's shooting bows and arrows at a cat. So each case has to be treated on its own merits, and they all come from a different place. Unfortunately, the law just usually has only one category, and everything just gets lumped together.
Mm-hmm. We only have a couple minutes left, and I just kind of wanted to take it out a little bit away from interpersonal violence and maybe just touch a little bit about institutionalized animal cruelty. I did see on one of the newsletters from the Link Coalition about the 2009 study, which showed clear links between slaughterhouse employment and higher reports of violent crimes and rape and sexual offenses. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we don't have a tremendous amount of research on that yet. Intuitively, it makes sense. I suspect as we get more reports out, we will find that. But, I mean, to be honest, it could also be with the type of people who work in slaughterhouses. I mean, it's a very difficult, very distasteful job, at least in the U.S. A lot of it is being done by immigrants coming from countries where, you know, because they'll do the work that nobody else will. And they may be coming from countries where they're not pet friendly to begin with. So you've got that plus, you know, the whole nature of the community. So, I mean, there are a lot of factors involved with that. We just really don't know that much.
Mm-hmm.
We also suspect that in dogfighting communities, you know, their attitudes towards pets are completely different than, you know, what people like you and I might think of, and you know, certainly, you know, when we're dealing with immigrants, whether they're Asian or Middle Eastern or Latin American, coming from cultures where, you know, pets are just not as widely you know, found in the home as, you know, what we're accustomed to, it's just a whole different cultural standard.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's interesting, and definitely more research needs to be done into that kind of desensitization. And I wanted to thank you, Phil. That's all the time we have today. So thank you for shedding light on these important connections. I really appreciate your wisdom.
Well, I appreciate it. Just tell your listeners, go to nationallinkcoalition.org. We have a free monthly electronic newsletter if anybody wants to participate. We have a lot of readers in Canada as well. And we've got lots of great information to help you do this work.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Phil.
Thank you.
All right, you're listening to 100.5 FM, Vancouver's Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, Canada. That pretty much wraps up our show. I wanted to direct listeners, of course, to our website, animalvoices.org, where you'll find all our past shows and some videos and links to everything that we talk about. And we also have, we're on Facebook and Twitter, and that's where you can stay up to date on our most recent shows and everything. And Facebook, it's Animal Voices Vancouver, and Twitter, it's Animal Voices YVR. So please do keep in touch. If you have suggestions or feedback for us, we really do appreciate it. We see ourselves as a community platform, and we want to be involved. So send us a line at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. And next week, of course, we will have another fun show for you. We're going to leave you with a song today by a group called Consolidated. It's called The Sexual Politics of Meat, and it's based
very
on
thematic.
The book by Carol Adams. I really enjoyed finding this song. So I hope you enjoy the song. And remember to be kind to animals. Thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you next week.
Of patriarchal values. Meat eating is the reinscription of male power at every meal. The patriarchal gaze sees not the fragmented flesh of dead animals, but appetizing food. Vegetarian activities counter patriarchal consumption and challenge the consumption of death. Feminist vegetarian activity declares that an alternative worldview exists, one which celebrates life rather than consuming death. One which does not rely on resurrected animals, but empowered people. If meat is a symbol of male dominance, then the presence of meat proclaims the disempowering of women. The notion of objectification one step further. Not only have we objectified animals, but in objectifying them, we take what we want from them and leave the rest out. We leave their death out and we take their bodies. We leave the images of their death out, but take the meaning of meat and apply it to women.